A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hey, Herman and Corin. So as you may know, I've been doing contracting and self-employed work for quite a lot of time at this point. And there is a lot to talk about on the subject, but there's a few episodes in particular that I want to send in or prompts for you to work through, because they're going to talk about the parts of being an effective self-employed person or business owner, if you're, you know, providing professional services, let's say, that have nothing to do with whether you're good at what you do. If you're good at building AI pipelines, building, you know, working as an architect, you can be the best person in the world at your skill. But if you're lousy at these things, it can be a problem. And I'm not talking about client relationships, although that is 100% in this category. But I'd like to actually start with a nuts and bolts conversation about contracts and scope, because this, in my experience, is the hardest thing to get right. We've talked before about the kind of formulations and boundaries of how many clients can and should you have. And I think that the potentially great thing about freelancing or self-employed work is that if you play it right, and that's a gigantic if with all the underlining in the world under it, then you can actually mitigate the risk and reduce the risk of that goes with any job. Because people would look at self-employment and think that's a recipe for it. That sounds insanely risky, but forget the point that if you're in a jurisdiction where employment is considered, it will, your sole source of income might be, could be taken away for an arbitrary reason, which I'm not saying isn't the case in for a freelance client. I've seen it happen. Clients just fold projects, and that's your part of your income gone. But if you can have a few of those running at one time, you can de-risk any one client to make it less of a catastrophic risk. So the first thing that we kind of talked about before, but let's revisit, is I would say the minimal number of clients that you'd personally recommend. Now, that's kind of too broad, really, for most. But we can give some rough parameters. And I think we should talk about why having a single client is always a bad idea. Because you'll find no shortage of clients who will try to convince you with attractive terms to take on that relationship. And I have personally seen that it tends to work out really badly because you'll end up in a pseudo-employment relationship. So let's talk about a minimal viable client load. And let's also talk about formulating contracts, because there's a whole discussion, how can you bill? And it's going to depend on so many different factors. But part of knowing what to bill is defining what you're actually there to do and having a working contract. One of the challenges I found in work that I did years ago in writing is there is a really hard balance to get right. And this isn't what I'm selling these days, but for years, did a lot of tech writing, white paper writing, all that sort of stuff. You don't want to be the guy who says, I can only have 30 minutes, you've 30 minutes a week to have a call. You get precisely two revisions and that's it. Anything extra is billed at this. Now, I actually ended up kind of being that guy, reluctantly, but being that guy because of that one client in every five who would, you know, come around for the fourth round of revisions. Or, this is something I saw happen once, 3 months later, popped out with, oh, we've just got back to you with another round of revisions for this white paper. And you're like, wait, didn't you say that was approved? And I'm on holidays at the moment, so no, I can't get those changes back tomorrow. So you learn from your errors. And in this case, there was, you know, terms and conditions went in, like you have to communicate your revision request within X days after receipt to prevent that kind of thing happening. So let's talk about these, the nuts and bolts of billing, you know, net 30 billing, taking deposits up front, whatever folks are doing that they're self-employed in. There's a few real pitfalls, in my experience, lying in the way, but not ones that I think could be prevented or avoided by judicious planning and thinking about what those are and what terms exactly you're prepared to contract under. I'm being clear about those because there is an enormous asymmetry in this kind of work typically. And sometimes the actual negotiations become pragmatic. No, and this is another, probably another episode, but I've been in that situation where you're trying to, you know, close a contract with Microsoft and you're, and they send it off to approval for legal. And you say, here's my contract. And they say, buddy, we're not using your contract. You know, so often it comes down to taking what the other side, their template, and working within that. But either way, it's possible not to get burned. And let's talk about how to actually avoid those pitfalls in today's episode.
Daniel sent us this one, and I want to frame it properly because it's actually several questions wrapped in one. He's been contracting and self-employed for years, and he wants to talk about the stuff that determines whether you succeed or fail, that has nothing to do with being good at what you do. Specifically, he's asking about a minimal viable client load, why having a single client is always a bad idea, and the nuts and bolts of contracts and billing. How to set terms, avoid scope, creep, handle deposits, net 30 billing, all the practical mechanics that keep you from getting burned. And Herman, before we dive in, DeepSeek Vi 4 Pro is writing our script today.
Fresh ink from DeepSeek, I like it. So this topic, corn, this is the stuff nobody talks about when they romanticize freelancing. They talk about freedom and working in pajamas. They don't talk about the client who comes back 3 months later with a fourth round of revisions while you're on holiday.
And Daniel's point about risk is the one I wish more people understood. The conventional wisdom says a full-time job is the safe route, and self-employment is the risky one. But if you're in an at-will employment jurisdiction, your entire income can vanish on a Tuesday afternoon because someone in a conference room decided to restructure. That's a single point of failure.
That's exactly the framing. And I think the first thing to say is that a single freelance client isn't diversification. It's a job without benefits. You've traded your W-2 for a 1099, you've lost your health insurance, your paid leave, your employment protections, and in exchange you've gotten the illusion of independence.
Daniel's right that clients will actively push you toward this arrangement. They'll offer attractive terms. They'll dangle a retainer that looks like a salary. They'll say they want you to be part of the team. It sounds great until you realize you're in a pseudo-employment relationship where they have all the control and you have none of the protections.
I saw a breakdown of this on the Freelancers Union site a while back. They call it misclassification risk from the client side, but from the freelancer side, it's worse. You're dependent on one source of income, you've stopped marketing yourself, your network atrophies, and if that client goes away, you're starting from zero. It can take months to rebuild a pipeline.
Let's talk numbers. Daniel asked for a minimal viable client load. What's your number?
I'd say 3 is the floor. 3 clients where no single one represents more than 50% of your income. That's the number where, if you lose one, and you will lose one eventually, projects end, budgets get cut, companies get acquired, you're hurt, but you're not in free fall.
I'd go further and say 3 is the absolute minimum, but 4 to 5 is where you actually sleep at night. And I know people will push back and say, that's too many to manage, that you can't do quality work across that many relationships. But that's a time management problem, not a structural one.
And it depends on what kind of work you're doing. If you're doing high-touch consulting where each client needs 15 or 20 hours a week, okay, 3 might be your ceiling. If you're doing project-based work with bursts of intensity, you can handle more. But the principle holds, no single client should be able to destroy you.
The other thing about the single client trap, and Daniel hinted at this, is that it warps the relationship. When you have one client, you can't say no. You can't push back on scope creep. You can't enforce boundaries. Because what are you going to do? Fire your only client. So you end up saying yes to everything, working nights and weekends and building resentment.
The client doesn't even respect you more for it. They just learn that you're available at 11 p.m. on a Saturday. I've seen this pattern so many times. The freelancer thinks they're building goodwill by being endlessly accommodating, and the client just recalibrates their expectations downward, or upward, from the freelancer's perspective, about what's reasonable to ask.
That's the client load question. 3 minimum, 4 to 5 ideally, no single client above 50%. Now let's get into the contract stuff, because this is where Daniel's experience really shows. the revision problem he described. The client who comes back months later after something was supposedly approved. That's a classic failure of contract language.
It's one of those things where you don't know you need it until you've been burned. Daniel mentioned he ended up being that guy who says you get precisely 2 revisions and anything extra is billed separately. And he said he became that guy reluctantly, but he became that guy because of that one client in 5 who abuses the system.
Every freelancer I know has a version of this story. The contract that didn't specify a revision window. The project that was approved verbally, but never signed off in writing. The client who interprets unlimited revisions to mean, I can iterate forever at no additional cost.
Let's break down what a solid contract actually needs. First, scope of work. And this is where most people are too vague. They write something like design website or write white paper. That's not a scope. That's a topic sentence.
Harel's scope of work specifies deliverables, formats, lengths, number of pages, number of screens, number of words. It specifies what's included, and this is the part people skip. What's explicitly excluded? If you're writing a white paper, how many words, how many interviews, how many rounds of research? Are graphics included? Is sourcing included? What's the citation format?
Daniel's example is perfect. You need 3 things: a number of included revision rounds, a definition of what constitutes a revision versus a new request, and a time window. So something like 2 rounds of revisions are included. Revision requests must be submitted within 14 days of receiving the deliverable. Requests submitted after 14 days will be treated as new work and billed at the standard rate.
The time window is the part people forget. Without it, you get the client who sits on a draft for 3 months and then comes back with changes, and you're expected to drop everything because technically you haven't done your second round of revisions yet.
It's not just about fairness to you, although that matters. It's also about project momentum. If a client takes 3 months to get back to you with feedback, the context has evaporated. You've forgotten the nuances of the project. You've moved on to other work. Restarting is cognitively expensive.
Daniel mentioned the asymmetry problem, and this is real. When you're a solo freelancer and the client is Microsoft or some large organization, they're going to insist on using their contract template. You're not going to win that fight. But that doesn't mean you're powerless. You can still negotiate specific clauses within their template.
In my experience, large organizations are actually easier in some ways. Their legal departments have standard fallback positions. They have processes. The real danger is the mid-sized company that doesn't have a formal procurement process, but still has enough leverage to push you around. They'll send you a contract that some founder drafted in a Word document 5 years ago, and it's full of landmines.
Let's talk about payment terms, because this is where a lot of freelancers leave money on the table, sometimes literally. Daniel asked about net 30 billing, deposits, all of that.
Net 30 is standard, but it's terrible. You're essentially extending 30 days of credit to a client. If you invoice on the first of the month and they pay net 30, you're waiting until the end of the month. And that's if they pay on time, which many don't. Net 60 is worse. Net 90 is basically you being a bank.
Large companies are notorious for this. They'll have a policy of net 60 or net 90, and they'll still manage to pay late. I've heard stories of freelancers waiting 120 days for payment from Fortune 500 companies. The freelancer is supposed to be grateful for the prestige of the client while the rent is due.
What do you do? Always, always, always take a deposit up front. For new clients, 50% is standard. For established clients with good payment history, you might go down to 25%, but never start work without money in hand. It's the single best filter for serious clients versus tire kickers.
It aligns incentives. If the client is paid 50% up front, they're motivated to give you timely feedback and keep the project moving. If they've paid nothing, they can ghost you for 6 weeks, and it costs them nothing.
Second, milestone payments. For larger projects, break the work into phases and tie payments to deliverables. Phase 1 deliverable, phase 1 payment. Phase 2 deliverable, phase 2 payment. This limits your exposure. You're never owed more than 1 phase's worth of work.
Third, kill fees. This is the clause that says if the client cancels the project, they pay a percentage of the remaining contract value. Because here's what happens without a kill fee. You turn down other work to reserve capacity for a client. The client cancels the project in month 2 of a 6-month engagement, and you're left with nothing and a hole in your calendar.
Kill fees are hard to negotiate, I'll be honest. Clients resist them because they feel like they're paying for nothing. But the way to frame it is, you're paying for the opportunity cost. I reserve time for you that I could have sold to someone else. If you cancel, I need to be made whole for that lost opportunity.
You don't have to be aggressive about it. A sliding scale works well. Cancellation within the first 30 days is 25%. Within 60 days is 50%. After 90 days is 75%. Something like that. The exact numbers depend on the project.
Let's talk about the scope creep problem specifically, because this is where contracts meet reality. Scope creep isn't usually malicious. It's death by 1,000 small requests. Can you just add this one thing? Could we tweak that? Oh, while you're in there.
The freelancer says yes because saying no feels unprofessional. You want to be helpful. You want to be easy to work with. And then you look up and you've done an extra 40 hours of work for free.
The solution is a change order process. It doesn't have to be formal or intimidating. It can be as simple as an email that says, "That sounds like a great addition." It's outside the original scope, so I'll put together a quick estimate for the additional work. You're not saying no. You're saying yes, and here's what it costs.
The key is to make the change order process routine and low friction. If every scope change requires a formal document and a meeting, you'll avoid doing it because it's too much overhead. But if it's just an email confirmation and an updated estimate, you'll actually use it.
This protects the client too, by the way. A good change order process means the client knows exactly what they're getting and what it costs. There's no surprise invoice at the end. The alternative, just doing the extra work and billing for it without prior agreement, is how you get disputes.
Daniel mentioned the writing work he used to do, and that's a domain where scope creep is particularly insidious because the deliverable is intangible. With a website, you can point to a screen and say, "That's new." With a white paper, the client says, "Can you expand on this section?" And it feels like a small ask, but expanding that section might mean new research, new interviews, new citations.
Writing is brutal for this. I've talked to freelance writers who say the single best thing they ever did was define the revision process in excruciating detail. Not just the number of rounds, but what constitutes a round. If the client sends feedback in 17 separate emails over 3 weeks, is that one round or 17?
The answer is, that's one round if you define it that way. You can say in the contract, "A revision round consists of all feedback submitted within a 7-day review period. Feedback submitted after that period constitutes a new round." Now the client has an incentive to consolidate their feedback instead of dribbling it out.
Here's a subtle point that Daniel alluded to, the difference between being rigid and being clear. He said he didn't want to be the guy who says, "You get precisely 30 minutes a week for calls and 2 revisions, and that's it." But he became that guy because the alternative was being exploited.
The distinction is between being rigid and having boundaries. Rigid is arbitrary. Boundaries are principled. If you can explain why the boundary exists, "I limit calls to 30 minutes because I do my best work in focus blocks and context switching kills my productivity." Most reasonable clients will respect that.
The unreasonable ones won't, and that's useful information. If a client pushes back on reasonable boundaries during the contract negotiation, they're telling you who they are.
Let's talk about intellectual property and ownership, because this trips people up. In most freelance contracts, the client owns the work product. That's standard and expected, but there are nuances.
The big one is, when does ownership transfer? The standard language is, upon full payment, not upon delivery, not upon approval, upon full payment. If the client hasn't paid you, they don't own the work. This is your leverage.
Then there's the question of tools and processes. You might build a custom framework or a set of scripts or a methodology while working on a client project. Who owns that? If the contract says, all work product, does that include your internal tools?
This is where you carve out pre-existing intellectual property and independently develop tools. You're not giving the client ownership of your entire toolkit just because you used it on their project. A good contract distinguishes between the deliverable, which they own, and the means of production, which you own.
Another payment term worth discussing, late fees. Net 30 with a 2% monthly late fee is common. Does anyone actually enforce this? In my experience, not often, but its presence in the contract changes behavior. Clients who know there's a late fee pay on time.
It's a signal. It says, I take payment seriously. And if you do have to enforce it, you have the contractual basis to do so. Without it, you're just sending increasingly awkward emails asking where your money is.
Daniel asked about the minimal viable client load, and I want to circle back to that with a point I don't think gets made enough. The number of clients isn't just about risk mitigation, it's about pricing power.
Say more about that.
When you have one client, they know they're your only client. Even if you don't tell them, they can sense it. You're always available. You respond to emails in minutes. You never have scheduling conflicts. And that gives them leverage, consciously or unconsciously, to push on rates and terms.
Whereas when you have four or five clients, you're genuinely busy. You're not available for a last-minute call on a Friday afternoon because you're working on someone else's deadline. That scarcity makes you more valuable, not less. It's counterintuitive, but true.
The client who has to book time with you a week in advance values that time more than the client who can get you on the phone in 5 minutes. Human psychology doesn't change just because we're talking about business.
There's a related point about rate setting. When you have multiple clients, you have real market data. You know what different clients are willing to pay. You can test rate increases with new clients before applying them to existing ones. You're not guessing. You're pricing based on evidence.
Let's talk about retainers, because Daniel mentioned them as a potential trap, but they're also a useful tool when structured correctly. A retainer is essentially a client, prepaying for a block of your time or a set of deliverables each month.
The danger is the retainer that's really a salary in disguise. The client pays you a fixed amount monthly, and in exchange you're expected to be available whenever they need you for whatever they need. That's not a retainer. That's a job with worse tax treatment.
A proper retainer specifies what the client gets for their money. X hours per month, Y deliverables, Z meetings. Anything beyond that is billed separately. And this is crucial. The hours don't roll over. If they don't use their allocation in a given month, they lose it. Otherwise, you're just building up an unmanageable backlog of owed work.
The retainer should be paid in advance. You're not invoicing at the end of the month for work already done. The client pays on the first, and that buys them your availability for the month ahead. If they don't pay, you don't work.
This is also where a use-it-or-lose-it clause actually serves the client's interests, counterintuitively. Without it, clients let work pile up, they don't prioritize, and then 6 months later they want everything done at once. The monthly reset forces them to engage consistently.
I want to talk about the contract negotiation itself, because Daniel mentioned the Microsoft scenario. You send your contract, they send back, we're not using your contract. How do you handle that?
You read their contract very carefully, and you focus on the clauses that actually matter. You're not going to win on governing law or indemnification or most of the boilerplate, but you can absolutely negotiate scope, payment terms, kill fees, and revision windows. Those are business terms, not legal terms, and business people can override legal on those.
You look for the landmines. Non-compete clauses are the big one. A lot of corporate contracts have broad non-compete language that would prevent you from working with anyone in their industry. For a freelancer, that's existential. You need to strike that or narrow it dramatically.
Intellectual property assignment is another one. Some contracts have language that assigns not just the deliverables, but anything you create during the engagement, even if it's unrelated. You need to narrow that to work product created specifically for and paid for by the client.
Here's a practical tip. When you're negotiating with a large organization, don't send a marked up contract as your first move. Send an email with 3 or 4 bullet points. These are the areas where I'd like to discuss modifications. It's less confrontational, and it lets the business stakeholder go to legal with specific asks rather than a red line document.
That's good. It frames the conversation as problem solving rather than a legal battle. Here's what I need to make this engagement work. Lands differently than, here are my proposed changes to section 4.2.
Let's talk about the deposit question more concretely, because Daniel asked specifically about this. When do you ask for a deposit? How much? And how do you handle clients who resist?
For new clients, I'd say 50% upfront is standard for project work. For ongoing retainer work, first month in advance. If the client resists, you have a conversation about why. Sometimes it's a cash flow issue on their end. They have a budget cycle. They need an invoice to trigger payment, whatever. Those are solvable problems.
Sometimes the resistance is a red flag. A client who won't pay a deposit is often a client who doesn't intend to pay on time, or at all. I've heard too many stories of freelancers who waived the deposit as a gesture of good faith, and then spent 6 months chasing an invoice.
The other thing about deposits is that they solve the onboarding problem. When a client is paid 50%, they're committed. They're not going to drag out the kickoff process or delay providing the materials you need, because their money is already on the table.
For the freelancer, the deposit solves the cash flow problem. You can buy the tools you need, block the time, maybe even turn down other work because you've got money in hand. It de-risks the engagement from both sides.
I want to address something Daniel said about the asymmetry of negotiations. He's right that the power dynamic is real. A solo freelancer versus a corporate legal department is not a fair fight. But there's an asymmetry in the other direction too, and freelancers often forget it.
What do you mean?
The client needs the work done. They've gone through a sourcing process, they've evaluated candidates, they've chosen you. By the time the contract hits your inbox, they're already invested. They don't want to start over. That gives you more leverage than you think.
The cost of switching, even just the cognitive cost of finding someone new, briefing them, getting them up to speed, is real. You can use that. Not aggressively, not as a threat, but as a quiet source of confidence in the negotiation.
You're not being difficult. You're being professional. And professionals have standard terms. Doctors don't negotiate their copay. Lawyers don't waive their retainer. Why should freelancers be different?
Let's talk about the revision window specifically, because Daniel's story about the client coming back 3 months later is so common. The fix is simple contract language. Revision requests must be submitted within X days of receiving the deliverable. After X days, the deliverable is deemed accepted.
The deemed accepted language is important. Without it, there's no closure. The project is perpetually open. With it, there's a clear point where the work is done, and any further changes are new work.
What's your X?
It depends on the project. For a white paper, 14 days feels right. It's enough time for multiple stakeholders to review and consolidate feedback, but not so long that the project goes cold. For a website or a software project, maybe 30 days because testing takes time.
You can build in an extension mechanism. If the client needs additional review time, extensions are available upon request. That way you're not being rigid, but the default is closure, not indefinite limbo.
Another contract clause that doesn't get enough attention, the communication and feedback consolidation clause. This says that the client will designate a single point of contact who consolidates all internal feedback before sending it to you.
Oh, this is huge. Without this, you get feedback from 7 different stakeholders, some of it contradictory, and you're expected to synthesize it all. You're not just doing the creative work, you're doing the client's internal politics for free.
It's a perfectly reasonable request. To keep the project efficient and avoid conflicting direction, please designate one person to consolidate all feedback. Most clients will appreciate the structure. The ones who push back are telling you their organization is chaos, and you should price accordingly.
Let's talk about termination clauses. Every contract needs a clear termination process. How much notice? What happens to work in progress? What gets paid?
30 days notice is standard for ongoing engagements. For project work, the kill fee we discussed earlier serves this function, but the termination clause should also address what happens to the work product if the engagement ends early.
The standard language is that the client pays for work completed up to the termination date, and they get the work product for what they paid for. They don't get work they haven't paid for, and you don't hold completed work hostage. It's clean.
Here's a nuance. If you're working on something that's not divisible, say a strategy document that's only useful when complete, you need language that addresses partial delivery. Otherwise, you do 80% of the work. The client terminates, and they get nothing useful while you get paid for 80%, and everyone's unhappy.
That's where milestone-based work really shines. Each milestone is a complete, useful deliverable. If the engagement ends after milestone 2, the client has 2 useful things and you've been paid for 2 things. No partial credit, no disputes.
I want to circle back to something Daniel said at the very beginning of his prompt, that the hardest thing to get right is contracts and scope. I think he's right, but I'd add that the reason it's hard is that it requires you to think about failure modes before anything has gone wrong.
When you're excited about a new project and the client seems great and everyone's optimistic, sitting down to write a contract that anticipates non-payment, scope creep, and early termination feels almost hostile. It feels like you're planning for the relationship to fail.
The counterintuitive thing is that clear contracts make relationships better, not worse. When expectations are explicit, there's less room for disappointment and resentment. The client knows what they're getting. You know what you're delivering. There's no subtext.
I'd go further and say that the contract conversation is a relationship building exercise. When you talk through scope and revisions and payment terms, you learn how the client thinks. Do they push back on everything? Do they try to nickel and dime you? Or are they reasonable and collaborative?
It's an audition in both directions. You're auditioning for them, but they're also auditioning for you. And too many freelancers forget they're allowed to fire clients. If the contract negotiation reveals someone who's going to be a nightmare to work with, you can walk away.
That's the ultimate risk mitigation, isn't it? Having enough clients that you can afford to say no to a bad one. Which brings us right back to where we started, the minimal viable client load.
3 minimum, 4 to 5 ideally. No single point of failure. Contracts that specify scope, revisions, payment terms, and termination. Deposits upfront. Change orders for anything outside scope. And the confidence to enforce all of it because you're not dependent on any one client.
The thing I'd leave listeners with is this. None of this is about being difficult or rigid. It's about being professional. The best clients, the ones you actually want to work with, will respect clear terms. They run businesses too.
The clients who bristle at reasonable boundaries are the ones who are planning to take advantage of you. They're self-identifying.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1980s, researchers discovered that cuttlefish camouflage patterns produce acoustic signatures distinct enough that sonar can distinguish a cuttlefish mimicking sand from one mimicking coral, even when the visual match is perfect to the human eye.
Cuttlefish are acoustically committed to their disguise. If you're freelancing or thinking about it, get your contracts in order. It's not the fun part of the work, but it's the part that keeps you solvent. This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing. Find us at My Weird Prompts. We'll be back soon.
See you then.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.